Let's face it, the New York Knicks are fickle. They play soft, they play hard. One minute they're the Ringo Stars of the Garden, the next, the shitty Beatles. But 14 seasons ago had us all walking on lilies and needles. Now that allusion to the ancient Chinese medicine practice known as acupuncture probably went over most of your tiny little heads. Just know this pun and all others are entirely unintended. Either way, this insatiable laundry list of linsanity resulted in this shitstorm of media attention and numerous letters to the editor, all from a series of unfettered comments and ambiguously racist headers. I guess what I'm asking is, should every wannabe linguist be dismissed when they let slip a slip of the tongue that stings, stinks, and stuns? I mean, whoever thought journalists would get fired for running puns? I used to have an Uncle Tom. He was a 6'8 conservative Caucasian who happily lived in Cali with his wife and 6'7 son. If it wasn't for an injury to his right hip and an innate desire to get an Ivy League transcript, Uncle Tom might one day have played for the New York Jets. Now, if someone else in my family eventually chooses finishing college and health ahead of career advancement, fame, and wealth, can I ever get away with saying he or she's an Uncle Tom? I mean, as long as you're brought up to speed on the story, am I permitted to personalize the lexicon without being derogatory? Or let's just say my materialistic ex-girlfriend, a nice Jewish American princess with a killer left, is caught yelling at our sushi chef. I wouldn't dare call her a Jap without being slapped in the chin, since nobody knows if I was directing my slurs to her or him. Now, the death of a Charlie would make any young Vietnamese soldier boy sublimely upset, unless in reference to a muffed-up love connection resulting in Chuck Woolery's untimely death. Sure, honkies can be a one-man band during a traffic feud, and Cracker? Well, that just tracks this white dude's predilection for lightly salted snack food. But no matter what, a chink in the armor, it just sounds so gross, offensive, and rude, especially when used in relation to an Asian, no matter how amazing a player may or may not be playing. Now, I could tell you to just not say it, but who am I to tell you what you can or cannot say? After all, aren't I repping the white man who's kicked out, murdered, enslaved, and raped for generations, leaving this embarrassed Caucasian pretty red in the face? And that's not meant as a slight at Native Americans or First Nations, but let's face it, it's getting harder to frame any thought without upsetting race relations. Like, I can't call Irish singer Bono Mick, even if his current swagger reminds me of Mick Jagger. And follow me on this one, where context is key. I can't let you know a bunch of faggots broke my fall when I fell out that tree. No homo, phones, or homonyms, hyperbole, simile, synecdoche. Basically, we're slowly purging the world of any and all ways to wordplay. So how do we say what we want to say? Well, the Founding Fathers set out to assure our First Amendment rights could never be breached. But what's next, the law restricting freedoms of figures of speech? I mean, unless he was the first one testing a new drug helping middle-aged men with urinary tract infections, better piss, I could never call my Italian cop friend Guinea Pig Chris. So I guess what it all massage oils down to is this. Does an apartment demanding to be spick and span ever consider who's cleaning? Or does it matter either way? Because even if you don't mean to be mean, one meaning of a double meaning can be so demeaning it changes the meaning of what you really meaning to say. So know the difference, expand that vocab, and try to find another way.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you.
So a few notes on this episode. Before we had settled in on the name Real Poets, we thought it would be cute to call the podcast Poets on Film. So
This is a bit of a throwback to the early incarnations of real poets.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Poets on Film. I'm Renzo del Castillo.
Poets on Film, a poet on film. And I'm Scotty T, a.k.a. Scott Raven, here to talk about 2015's
Howl!
Howl, yes.
A film about Allen Ginsberg's
opus.
Milestone poem, right?
Milestone poem. I like that. I do have to tell you off the top, I did a show back in the early 2000s, and I had a puppet named Howl the Owl.
No, you didn't.
Yes, and it was, I saw the best bird brains of my generation.
Okay.
But yeah, I did a whole puppet show.
You were born to be a dad. Like, that's amazing.
It was basically like a stuffed animal that had lost its stuffing, and then I made it into kind of a puppet. But Howl the Owl, a wise little puppet, and this film from a wise man, I would say. I always see Ginsberg as kind of like I know the Buddhist influence, but yeah, like a wise man. We got a lot to talk about today with this movie. The Beat Generation, definitely an early precursor to slam and performance poetry, kind of that in your face style. The Beat Generation, what was your first exposure maybe to the beats?
It was Ginsberg and Howl. I forget the name for the person who it was dedicated to, but Howl, the song for somebody that he met while he was serving some time in a mental institution. I actually got into the Beat Generation because I was exploring what counterculture meant. I mean, as an immigrant, right, you come here, like, what is culture? What is counterculture? And there was this pretty huge cultural revolution in the 1950s. There was a growing sense of rebellion in American society and its norms, especially regarding sexuality, regarding freedom of expression, anti-establishment sentiments. And this film, a hefty part of it, goes into an obscenity trial that we'll discuss a little bit more in the future that happened when Howl was first published. It went to trial to see if it was going to be censored.
Yeah. All the freedom of speech in jeopardy, which we're seeing here. You know, a constant battle. The term beats or beatniks. You know, you have like the rhythm aspect to it. But I'm curious. I mean, have you heard? I had heard once that it had to do with police brutality early on. That possibly beatnik coming from beat and then the N word attached to it. I had heard beat. You know, kind of like, all right, beating to your own drum. Kind of saying what's on your mind. I know there's a couple conflicting schools of thought as to what it is.
I also want to mention that for a few years with Mayhem Poets, I attended the Howl Festival in New York City, an annual festival kind of celebrating the Beat Generation, the work of Ginsberg, with, outdoor festival with readings of Howl and poetry performances galore. One particular year after Mayhem Poets had won their Microsoft grant, we worked in conjunction with the slam poppy of the New Yorican and Bowery Poetry Club, Bob Holman, on kind of a presentation for Howl Festival. And what we did was we provided a service to all attendees in the form of Dalai Lama rides. That's right. Dalai Lama rides, more like Salvador Dalai Lama rides, because it was the head of the Dalai Lama attached to an actual llama attached to a shopping cart. And people would get in this shopping cart and I or one of the other poets would wheel them around the festival. And most notably, there was a woman with a giant white balloon, and there was another young lady with a giant iguana, all who partook in these Dalai Lama rides. Shout out to our designer of the shopping cart, the artistic design, by this woman named Carolyn Dentz. She created flyers for us at this time, took some really wonderful promotional pics, as well as was pretty instrumental when we had won this grant for Slam Chops, which was supposed to be a kind of poetry-themed restaurant with milk Shakespeare's and Al Ginsberger's, but turned into a kind of field trip experience for students in New York City to come to a poetry club and hear poets. And some of the poets would be myself and the other Mayhem poets, while others was a additional team that myself and Mason Granger trained to perform poetry for youth audiences. So if you were part of any of these Howl Fests in New York City, or you were affiliated in any way with Slam Chops, reach out to us at the Real Poets website. We'd love to hear from you, how you're doing, if you're still in some way involved with the poetry community, and you know what you're up to, and maybe even come on a future episode of Real Poets. Have you heard of the poet Bob Kaufman before?
No, please tell me more.
Well, basically, he was one of the seminal beat poets. Interestingly enough, took a vow of silence as a means of speaking out, or protesting rather, against certain political events. Now, I believe he started his vow of silence when JFK was assassinated and continued this vow for 12 years, only ending it when the Vietnam War came to a conclusion. I sometimes mix him up with this other poet, Alan Kaufman, who put out, he's one of the first spoken word poets, put out this book that was very important to me. He was in Aloud, Voices from the New Eureka Poets Cafe, but he also put out The Outlaw Bible of American Poetry. You should definitely check that out.
The power in saying, and then the power in not saying or reflecting. But Bob Kaufman, yeah, take a look at him. I know he was one of your early.
No, I'm definitely going to check him out. So why don't we do this? Let me
give us a little
give a little background, and then we'll get into it, because there's a number of topics I'd like to discuss regarding counterculture, the beatniks, Ginsberg himself, James Franco, how it can be problematic now years later, where their lives kind of mirror each other in a way, but mm-hmm. again, we'll go forward. So in terms of the overview of the film, it was released on September 24th in 2010. It was directed by Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman. It had two directors. It starred James Franco as Allen Ginsberg, John Hamm as a lawyer. There was Jeff Daniels as a witness, Mary Louise Parker in a bit role again as a witness. Aaron Tebbit played his lover. Just a number of people.
Great cast.
Great cast. It's considered to be a drama, a biography, also considered to be experimental, because the film is structured in an interesting way. It's structured through three main components. The first one is Ginsberg's poetry reading, which is the backbone of the movie, with James Franco portraying Allen Ginsberg as he reads from Hal at a public reading in 1955. But this is also animated as he reads the poem. This animation that was designed by, I forget the name of the person, but he had worked with Ginsberg on his illustrated poems and manuscripts. And then the second part of this movie is the court trial. It's a procedural. It's a courtroom drama unfolding as the publishers, because Ginsberg was not on trial, as they face charges for obscenity due to the controversial nature of the poem, which we'll discuss. And then there's also biographical elements. Flashbacks into Ginsberg's life through an interview that he's doing, offering insights into his relationships, his experiences in the Beat Generation, his journey writing Hal, which is juxtaposed with all of these other elements. And as we've discussed, you know, we can talk about the Beat Generation counterculture. We can talk a little bit more about the trial, also about Ginsberg's personal struggles and how that led him to develop the style that he did, and talk about the themes that he did in his poetry. And also there's the poem's form and legacy, which was a complete disregard for older poetry norms at the time. So why don't we start there?
So what do you? How was your reading? Let's start with the. Early with the reading. Intercutting it with kind of animation. It's tough. It becomes, a stereotype of itself a little bit, unless you've, been to an actual, poetry reading. It's hard to capture the immediacy on the film. It's hard to capture, what it really is like to be there at a poetry reading, hence the animation. Because you can't, there's things that can happen, moments that you can't predict for that are outside of, the page. This is depicted, I guess, black and white. Was the animation
in color?
In color. Worked to an extent. That poetry reading compared to the courtroom, it kind of goes back and forth. They're kind of like opposites, if you think about it. Like a courtroom is traditionally known as a place of decorum. You can't, can't ruffle the feathers. Whereas the poetry reading itself, anything can happen. Because of that, the courtroom scenes, they did get a little repetitive at times. It didn't necessarily connect with me all throughout. But, enjoyed the poetry scenes. I wonder if you saw those two as kind of like opposites.
I didn't see them as opposites. I saw them as complementary.
Complementary.
And I'll tell you why. So, for example, when the poetry reading is documented, the trial, the transcripts are documented, and the interview where he's going into and discussing the things that, his past and his influences and his experiences are also documented. But we're dealing with cinema. And I think when you look at, when the poetry reading is in black and white, or where aspect, or when he's discussing, when he's being interviewed, he's in color. When he's talking about his past experiences, they are also in black and white. I don't know if this is intended, but to me, this signals, take this with a grain of salt. This is his memory, his perspective. The black and white represents nostalgia to me, as opposed to when he's speaking on record, in transcript, on the, and when you have the court, which is in color. So to me, it's taking cinema to pay tribute to poetry, which is why I think it's adding layers of complexity. And did he have, his sexual relationships that he had, with his friend that is also named in the poem, was he as inviting as he's remembering him to be? Maybe yes, maybe no, but it's colored by his nostalgia, right? And when you look at a poem, it's colored by your nostalgia, by your glasses, your lens as to how you look at it. And I think it was a pretty interesting way to represent that dichotomy of what is true. Is it historically accurate or is it thematically accurate? Can you find truth in a lie? Can you find truth in misremembering? Because are the details and the facts as important as what the meaning is? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we explore in poetry. And I was wondering what you think about that.
Well, I like to think when you look at a photograph, it captures maybe one moment in freeze frame of everybody smiling and looking their best. It never takes into account, all right, there may have been fights during this time. There may have been screaming, there may have been tiredness, there may have been all these other sorts of emotions. A poem, I would like to be able to capture all of the emotions of an event. Poetry distills. It's like a sieve that kind of highly concentrates all the emotional potency into a visual picture for its listener or for its reader.
You're saying that scene is, I guess it's the director's vision a little bit, or somewhat with...
Or the screenwriters with the director.
With Franco, who's hopefully embodying, Ginsberg at that time. We can talk a little bit about whether or not is it obscene? Would it have been obscene? Is it meant to ruffle feathers? There's something about saying certain things. We got some poets within our community that say things that they, whether the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, or you want to reject it, but it gets you. Whether it's the tone, sometimes not even necessarily the what they're saying, you have a reaction. You have a reaction to something that, positive or negative, it is a reaction. I would rather feel that sometimes than nothing.
Right.
So, you know, if it spurs more dialogue after, if it, and that's the beauty of something like that. I used to tell you that, like, at these poetry readings, people used to heckle. They used to call out things in the middle of poems. As much as, you know, comedians, you know, like, they hate that.
Some comedians thrive on it.
Right.
But it's
confrontation, and it's different than what the show, you know, is. Let's say you're reading a poem off of a page, and somebody's shouting, like, no, or you know, go ahead, you know. Positive affirmation in the middle of poems is good. I think that feeds the reader. At the Beat Generation, that's where the snaps actually came from, you know, like, and the snaps was put into place, I think, so that there wasn't distraction in the middle of the poem. You could hear a punchline and it's just like quick out, and like you're acknowledging something, and then the flow kind of continues. It doesn't interrupt the flow. Plus it kind of has a bit of a rhythm, you know, rhythm tape to it. At the same time, I like the idea of somebody, you know, interrupting something or saying something if you're not holding attention. But decorum wise, yes, I'd rather they write a poem, they say something, and then they say something after the fact, or they write a poem in response to your poem rather than interrupting it. In that poem that I did for you, Linsanity, that term, Od nas nas nasht. And what that means, it's a Russian word meaning one meaningness, meaning one meaning. Now, in Soviet Russia, there was an outlawing of double meanings. So if we're talking about kind of like, imagine like the government didn't want you to say something that even it had the potential to be interpreted two ways. It almost felt like a, you know, like kind of a code. Which is fascinating. Like, and this it wasn't only spoken, it was like signs, things, anything that could be kind of like, all right, interpreted had to have one meaning, which is incredibly stifling as a writer and as a performer.
And that's what we go into in the trial, right? Like the use of language, which could be considered obscene. I have a part of the beginning of Hell, the first part of Hell, I think it's a poem in three parts. And I'm going to read a section.
Sure, sure.
Just so we can get the beat, get an idea of all that stuff. Again, this is my interpretation of it, but is, who howled on their knees in the subway and were dragged off the roof waving genitals and manuscripts, who let themselves be fucked in the ass by saintly motorcyclists and screamed with joy, who blew and were blown by those human seraphim, the sailors, caresses of Atlantic and Caribbean love, who bawled in the morning and the evenings in rose gardens and the grass of public parks and cemeteries, scattering their semen freely to whoever come who may. This was actually talked about in the movie as part of the trial, saying, like, why does he need to say blue or blown? Why is he talking about being fucked in the ass? But that's his experience, right? Mm-hmm. This is what he lived. And yes, I'm sure he's aware that the language was shocking. And in the interview section of the movie, he talks about that era, about this segment of the poem, where he's saying, who let themselves be fucked in the ass by saintly motorcyclists and screamed with joy. And he said, typically it would be with pain. You're expecting it to be pain, but the homosexual experience is one of joy. Uh-huh. And let me take you away from that and show you something different to give you a sense of what her experience was like. I'm paraphrasing, but he goes into that in the movie as Ginsberg during the interview when he's recounting his experiences. And those lines were a big section of the trial part of the movie, trying to determine, is this just obscene and we shouldn't do it? Or is this experience? And if you're promoting your experience, do you have value and literary merit, right?
Right.
Spoiler alert, they decided that yes, it did have literary merit.
It did have literary merit once it's dissected and yeah, the it was in favor. I'm interested, I guess, I'm in your opinion even on this. Certain audiences hear a word and they don't hear the context. They don't hear the rest of it. Somebody will hear maybe just one word of profanity and they will immediately reject hearing the rest of the poem. Somebody might hear free Palestine. They might hear Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And just from that word, their ears go off and they either reject hearing it. Yeah, like, and what do we, they sometimes they will put up a stir, you know, like, all right, you know, that shouldn't be here. This shouldn't be here. You know, you're still battling that, like, you know, even in a place of free speech. I know Harry had, you know, talked about a couple of places that, like, he said certain things and they're like, oh, we'd rather you not come back here or something like that.
Right.
And of course that fuels him wanting to do it more. So great victory for free speech there. Audiences, I know you shouldn't count out to the audiences, but they're going to do that. Will you consciously avoid saying something as with to not turn off a particular audience member at any time? Or, all right, my experience, I'm going to say
it. Well, it's interesting because there's another part to that, which is, will I avoid saying this and risk not being truly heard? Like, what is the truth of what I'm saying? Can I say this? Or in order to be heard and not put away and not be put in a box, I need to shock you into paying attention, right? And what I took away from the poem, Howl, is that it expresses how social constraints and modern culture, Moloch the machine, Moloch the technology, Moloch the buildings, they destroy great minds. Like, and it was Carl Sullivan, his friend that was the person who was serving time with him in a mental institution, that became his friend, who also ended up becoming a poet later when he came out, how it destroyed his mind. And it's interesting because we're watching a movie about a poet, about, again, like a linchpin of the Beat generation and counterculture, having his work be judged by society, by the constructs of a modern society, not allowing him to destroy his mind. And he's not even in the trial. He's like, I don't care. I don't care about this. Like, well, your publisher could go to jail. I feel so sorry for him.
Right.
He decided to publish it. It doesn't affect me. He's like, it's a reflection of, like, I'm not going to let this thing affect me. I don't want to be Carl Simon. That's what I took from it. Like, I'm just going to live. Because at first, it was a little jarring to me to see him disassociate and seem to not care what happens to the people that are supporting his work.
Right.
And I was like, wait, what kind of person is this? But as I got into the movie, I'm like, oh, he's taking care of himself. And that's something that I've learned to do. I grew up with my family always. We had very little, but whatever we had, we shared. We overshared to the point where we had nothing and helped other people out. And I developed this same habit until I learned I can't help people if my cup is empty. And I just saw a man making sure his cup was still filled, right?
I was curious to know if anything shocks you to this day. Is there, what's something that you can, like, that you, upon hearing, is shocking for you to hear, that you would hear and then, okay, yeah, I mean, like, wow. Or even to talk about. Is there things today? I always like to make kind of like the connection to hip hop a little bit too, where early in the birth of hip hop, you know, highly misogynistic, there was, you know, rhetoric being used. And I know Saul Williams, the poet, always talked about like the head bob, you know, where you're positively affirming things that you might not even agree with to keep the beat. Right, you know, like just bitches and hoes, and the rhythm keeps you on, but you're not even agreeing with what it actually is, and the rhythm actually keeps you into it. Then you have kind of underground hip hop that they're saying things that are a little more nuanced sometimes, emotionally complex, but people don't want to even, you know, the mainstream doesn't want to hear it because it doesn't have that beat. It's almost like subliminally some of these.
Or the mainstream takes something that's hip hop, makes it commercial, and then hip hop artists don't want anything to do with it. Like, I think about Macklemore when he came out with Thrift Shop, and then everybody's like, this guy's whack. He's not cursing.
Right.
I can tell you what shocks me to this day, and it's something I don't like talking about because I don't like giving it a voice, except to bring awareness and prevent it, is pedophilia, sexual abuse of children, having parents sexually abuse their kids, or having parents like kill their kids. It shocks me because I don't conceive how we as a society that's still happening. But then obviously I know, you know, like it's society doesn't control everything, but just like that, that being inside someone is something that to this day shocks me. And to see some people, you know, I have a really good friend of mine who was abused as a kid by a priest, and to see, I'm a Catholic, but seeing how the Catholic Church, like under John Paul II, under Benedict, just be more concerned with the soul, the redemption of the sinner instead of protecting the innocent. Like I can see that, but I don't buy it. Right. Yeah, and that's if I'm being kind to it. So things like that still shock me.
Shock. And those are definitely things that have appeared in films too, presented dealing with those. Yeah. And like, I wonder, you know, like hearing those within a poem sometimes, when presented with them, yeah, that's some of those similar to me, how it plays, you know, with which to the ear.
Yeah. It's, there was a Batman novel that I read a long time ago, and it had to do with Batman stopping an international child sex ring. Mm-hmm. And, this is crazy. I don't even remember the name of the book, but there was a poem in the book. It was a haiku that when Batman, Bruce Wayne, was feeling his lowest, like, how am I going to stop this evil's greater than me? Like, I can't stop it. The poem was a haiku that said, "Warrior, heed this. When battling with demons, aim not at their hearts." And that's something that stayed with me forever since I read it. And it's poetry. Poetry is what made it stick home for me, right? Like that haiku, that 5-7, you know, aim not at their heart. Warrior, heed this. 5. When battling with demons, 7, aim not at their hearts. 5. Like, it's just poetry helped it stick.
In a Batman comic.
In a it's a Batman novel. It was definitely not a comic. I'll find it. But it's just like the power of poetry. But even then, it wasn't overt, but it was talking about, you know, like you can't show empathy, or you can't deal with empathy with people that have none, right? Interesting take, but and that can be problematic in itself, but it's just something that stuck out. What about you? What shocked you?
Psychopathy and that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, what, you know, the shocking or what unnerves me is, yeah, it's a lot of the topics you talked about, you know, like a death of children, of babies, you know, recently came out in the news, the babies from October 7th, they had came back. And that's something that had...
Today, I saw that.
That, you know, whether I read about it, whether I hear about it, and that came even, you know, like just the epitome of innocence when something like that happens. Like, I just remember even at a very young age, train spotting, there was a scene that had something like that, you know, right? And like it just, wow, really just shocked me. Now, I often see things through a positive lens, or even sometimes a comedic lens, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the topics you mentioned through comedy can touch upon them. You know, they are able to do even, you know, those issues. But there has to be kind of, and oftentimes there is, an underlying truth that comes out of it, whether it's a personal experience that somebody's gone through, whether it's a, you know, once removed to somebody, they go, and then, you know, or their passion in their own lives of going counteracting against that. So I like to be able to be aware of the both, you know, to be able to share, you know, has to have the underlying truth, but also I would say, how, you know, comedic, you know, suicide, if we talk about a shock issue for someone to hear that, you know, can you joke about something of that if you're making a larger point, you know, that has to do with it, you know, like you're making a comment about people that joke about something rather than making light of that, I guess.
Like somebody like Anthony Jeselnik jokes about pedophilia a lot.
Right.
But in the larger scheme of things, he's calling attention to it, right?
He is.
It's interesting to see, like, it might not necessarily be my taste.
His is a tough one. I like it. They're funny, but
yeah.
They're great. I mean, he's a craftsman for sure. The words aren't wasted. And, you know, who knows, there's probably pain underneath that.
Definitely pain. There's definitely nuance. But if you just take one of his jokes offhand, you're like, what is this guy saying? Especially somebody like me who's still shocked by some of that stuff. But I understand what he's doing. And I don't feel like I'm like, oh, you need to stop talking about this or joking about this. Yeah. Because he's doing good, like you said, good work, good art, yeah, moving it forward and calling attention to a topic.
I mean, that's a tough one because oftentimes he'll invoke family. But it's not, I guess, the real, you know, like the uncle did this or mm-hmm. dad did this. And it's calling it, I guess it's still making a comment on that shit does exist. Yeah. And, you know, it's the
He's not celebrating. That's the thing. Like, if you pay attention, he's not celebrating this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, where the laugh, if outside of a comedy club, the punchline would be met with a, oh, man, yeah, he somehow managed it to be like a.
A lot has to do with delivery. Mm-hmm. A lot has to do with all that stuff. But let me ask you that question, like, to bring it back. We're talking about shocking things.
Right.
At the time, Hal was incredibly shocking. Do you think anything should be censored? Where do you stand on that?
Right. And I guess it comes down to age limits of censorship, right? Or you know, you have child locks on certain things. You have, you know, password protection on certain things. I believe that, you know, I don't want art to be censored, you know, but then it becomes a little bit of a tricky type of thing, right? When, you know, like an artist that's put out something and it maybe it hints at certain, whether it's sexual depravities or some other thing, and then that are in real life, it comes out that they were, you know, kind of a part of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So since censorship wise, yeah, I mean, I tend to be, you know, fully liberal on this matter. Early on in my career, I had this poem, the chicken poem. All right. And like, I start out with, have you seen those breasts? What I do to just lick those legs. And I performed at a middle school. And early on, I got, we had two shows started for a day. They canceled it after one because a PTA member rushed up to us and like, how are we going to start a show for middle schoolers with I Love Breasts? How are you going to possibly start a show with I Love Breasts? I mean, the poem, clearly it is about chicken. And we talk about, you know, double meanings in that. And, you know, like, it is meant to shock, to get attention right at the start. But it you know, ruffled some feathers.
Chicken.
And this member of PTA, she, you know, she was against it, okay? We finished the show, and as we're exiting, we see hundreds of kids. They're banging on the glass, like, cheering for us. Hmm. And that was enough value that we connected with them. Like that, however, you know, like that little moment, it was a door open. It might have been, you know, shocking at first, but then they heard the rest of the poem and they were able to have fun and like poetry and that sort of thing. So, you know, it has to be brought back, but there are always going to be those people that only hear what they want to hear. And, you know, and you know, you're not going to be, I guess, understood by everybody. I will say I did do that poem again in an elementary school, but now I change it. Instead of, have you seen those breasts? I say, did you see that skin? What I do to just lick those legs, still salivating sleep from those mesmerizing wings or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was an adaptation in the moment.
And that's interesting, right? Because for me, I don't have the answer to that. I don't know if you're more emotionally mature, like at 17 versus 18. I think it depends on the person. For me, a lot of it has to do with consent. Like, you obviously don't want pornography being shown to a child who has no idea what it is, or, you know, videos of bestiality. Like, there was that episode of Black Mirror where, like, the prime minister had to have sex with a pig in order to save somebody's life, right? Or something to that effect, like these nightmare scenarios. I definitely don't think that should be shown, but I don't think that pig had anything to say in the matter in this fictional situation. I do think that
emotional maturity.
It goes to freedom of religion, right? So right now we're dealing with freedom of religion in the country. As I think freedom of religion means that you have the freedom to practice your religion without being persecuted. I don't think it gives you the freedom to persecute others based on their religion. But I think that that's how some people are interpreting it, right? So censorship to me is this topic that there's no one size fits all to it. It has to be reviewed. I'm glad that we're seeing an example of when one of these things came to be reviewed, and it came out that no, due to, because
it's a societal contribution.
Yeah, it's a contribution to society. It's representing something that's true, and it has valid as a form of literature. It's contributing to the canon of literature. It moves forward. But let me move on to another part. What did you think of the animations? The other day, we talked about Naruto, and we talked about how the cinematography, how the editing, the mise-en-scène contributed to this ethereal, abstract nature of Naruto's poems and brought that out. What did you think of the animation and how it relates to Ginsberg's style of poetry? And not just the animation, you can go into the way the movie was edited, the three-part structure, the poem Howl is in three parts.
Right,
mirrors a lot of that. So what did you think about that?
Yeah, there's the reaction I had to it initially, and then, you know, after sitting with it for a while, you know, animation as a tool often used to kind of, yes, express kind of thoughts, and you can go outside the realms of reality. But like, if he is writing from a place of truth, you know, is like, imagine there's like a dramatization literally in real life of what's happening, how that plays differently to an animated approach to it. Then it becomes almost too shocking, which is interesting of how the animation in combination with the words, you're able to kind of hear it a little bit. It's kind of like a once removed. I don't know if it puts it more in a fantasy.
Well, it's abstract, right? Like the way that the animation was, and he described it, he was high. He was on something, and he looked at a building, and he's like, "Oh, Moloch, this is," and it was part of the inspiration of what the poem eventually became. But they're dreamlike, right? They're abstract, and it explored, you know, the themes of artistic representation in his poems. Like it definitely
and
moved
fantasy,
into the visions that he had. Like the way that Hal moves, it's not like you're talking about machines taking on the personification of oppressors and. These are not literal depictions of things in the way the animation reflects it.
Right. I mean, it's imagination. Yeah. I mean, that's poetry. Oftentimes I feel like there's just the emotion without the imagination that comes from people. This allows, the merging of the two.
Yeah, and I think it does move, even though his poem has structure. His poem has structure, but it is also, compared to what came before, it's a bit more abstract and it's a bit more free form. And I think that the animation reflected that in a way. And also the way that it cuts between animation, interview, and trial.
Right.
It also, I think, represents that.
Fantasy, truth, imagination,
yeah.
And all those. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we'll put a link in the notes for that actual animation. I would love to see if that animator has done some other simple things. You know, the idea of, I think animation just in general for poems is a cool pairing, being able to, you know, because often certain things express are that larger than life. I don't know if, have you seen any other, there's one by Shane Coizan about bullying that was a great TED talk that has great animation of a poem, but I think it's a great, you know, representation, a great tool to be able to use that. Yeah, tell me, what did you think? How did good old James Franco, you feel, embody? Because Ginsberg, I'm like, for me, Neruda, Ginsberg, I have a picture of,
mm-hmm.
kind of a look of. There's like the young Ginsberg and then kind of like the bearded, bald,
older
Ginsberg.
Yeah. I think he did a great job. He was understated. He even got like the mannerisms
the
way that
I was
Ginsberg
impressed by that.
Speaks. I didn't hear a lot of James Franco that you see in Pineapple Express or This Is the End
or interviews
or like it wasn't that, like that thing that he's known for in the mainstream. I didn't really see it come through. I saw him embody what I also know of Ginsberg, and it was a pretty raw portrayal, in my opinion, because there's a lot of vulnerability to Ginsberg. Ginsberg, I think if Ginsberg hides, he hides in oversharing, right? It's like when you get hit with so many things that it's... So, for example, there was this Ars Poetica poem, I forget by who, Carmen something. It was part of the Poetry Unbound podcast. And the poem goes, I am young, I am old, I am Gen X, I am Gen Z, I am this, I am that. And it's like oversharing. And by the time you're done, you don't know much about the speaker at all. You're overloaded with all of these things. And I don't know if Ginsberg is vulnerable or he's hiding in the details of his life. Like, his true vulnerability is inside there and you can't crack it because he's oversharing too much. He's shocking you too much. And I thought Franco... That's my opinion of Ginsberg, right? This is nobody else's, this is mine. And I saw Franco, maybe playing to my biases, I saw him embody that. What about you? What did you think?
Yeah. I hadn't thought of it being as much as an overshare. You know, he's that long lines, you know, it's kind of like there's a stream of consciousness happening where an idea kind of blends into the next. I would say with a lot of the beat poets, there is the drug connection, you know, and some of their thoughts and their fantasies, they're heightened and they are distorted through oftentimes a number of hallucinogens and that's another great thing to use animation for, to be able to express, you know, what one's mind happens during that. So whether it is even clear to him after that, I know a lot of those, you know, I mean, Burroughs in particular, I'm speaking of Ginsberg, from what I remember, he was able to pretty much remain pretty clear-headed throughout a lot of this, but some of the others that it had gotten in that way. I think it's a product too of just like, just so much stimuli coming on, and that's the way it's coming out.
What did you think about, so last time we were also speaking to Ruda and to a lesser extent to The Color of Pomegranates, when you have a figure like Neruda who is beloved, but then you find out that he talked about raping someone when he was younger in his memoirs, or that he was an absent parent who didn't seem to care about his daughter and abandoned her, who had a disability. And it just brings that into juxtaposition with this love, right? Like, you have James Franco, who's an actor, a pretty famous actor for a while, and then he got into trouble for sexual misconduct. And then you have Ginsberg with his own issues. I mean, what does that juxtaposition represent? I mean, like, does this make the movie Howl, or does this make the poem Howl any less of a milestone?
Right, any less of a milestone, or like you were saying, method acting.
Did he method act too much? Yeah.
You know, you're diving deep into that. You know, it's the artist spirit. You know, what came not as a shock to me, but when you have the people that appear to know him the closest, James Franco, they distance themselves from him, then it makes me think, because I don't know, you know, but if, you know, you had like, I guess, a Seth Rogen, you know, is he protecting his own brand, or is he like, look, you know, there's a lot of negativity attached to, you know, to you, and, you know, he's worked closely with him, and if he's distanced himself from him, you know, that says something, like someone who I would think is a friend of his. Granted, that's murky because he's in the Hollywood game as well, but perhaps. Haven't heard or sought out as much. I like to be able to, you know, if I had the opportunity, or obviously talk with the person, you know, initially, because you want to believe, you know, the women, anybody that has come in contact with it. But what access do you have to the real person anymore? You know, like, as to, you know, what's going on, whether you have a chance to, you know, listen to these people. In any event, you know, it was interesting where this is a guy that already achieved such a mega stardom, and then he's going back to college, right? It's just a recipe for power dynamic messiness. Mm-hmm. where he's with students often that haven't had a career, haven't, you know, started a career at all. And this is somebody that's in Spider-Man at this point, you know, globally known. So any type of thing, you know, he can use that to his advantage. They can use that to their advantage. Just the lines get, you know, murky. And him, as I guess, as a celebrity, has to know that too, going into a collegiate atmosphere like that. Okay, you want to be one of these students, but look, you know, you're a star already, you know, like that is your persona. I can watch, like we discussed before, I can watch these movies and make that separation. But when the subject matters are intertwined, you can't help it. It can be distracting.
I was about to, like, should how the movie be censored, right? Like that question.
Yeah.
That question comes up again. And I don't have the answer to that. I can tell you that I thought this was, again, three solid picks in terms of having movies that, I don't want to say accurately or competently attempt to show the inner workings of a poet, their mind, and their work. I enjoyed it. It's a very light, fast watch, but it definitely led me to re-examine and be inspired by my own work in terms of Ginsberg's contributions more so than before. It's just fresher in my mind.
Early on, I started, I had a poetry professor, Joel Lewis out of Jersey, got me really into the Beats, as well as Anselm Berrigan. I was reading a lot of kind of like Kerouac, Dharma Bums. It's interesting to me that, you know, the Mad Ones speech, you know, give me the Mad Ones, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's premise is, you know, like, be a trendsetter, be, you know, pave your own way, not conform to societal standards. And I've always taken that to heart too. Like, I live surrealistically, I'd like to do. But I find when people are quoting that line, it does the opposite. Because it's just that they are often quoting the line that's asking them to do it. And they hang on that, as opposed to taking the real messages. All right, don't just echo that. Create your own path, whatever that might actually
be. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's live authentically, right? And I have no problem hearing that or saying that. Because at the end of the day, if you want to live surrealistically, you can, because it's authentic to you. It varies from person to person.
Correct.
It's, I mean, what I've been recently thinking about, what is all this for? Other than the fact that I enjoy art, it's about connecting, and it's about, like, reminding each other that we're human and finding common ground and finding truth, right? I mean, for me, at least. So when I watch these movies, that they lead me to some sort of truth, it's enough for me right now.
Nice. You know, truth.
Again.
What is truth? Wearing clothes, you know, why this word is that word, you know, or anything that has been put on by any decision that has been created from society. And then you can go off into, you know, kind of la la land. But, you know, the cosmic joke of it all, when you think of what we came from and, you know, like where we are now, all of this is somewhat constructed. So yes, to live authentically and connect. And that, you know, like the way with which what is essentially a human between us, that are able to connect, you know, is it words? Is it behavior? Is it emotion? That sort of thing. You know, nothing means anything, really.
Words mean something, right?
Given that, you know, create your own meaning a bit. You know, everybody's having their own type of experience. The idea of, like, what you are seeing through your eyes might be entirely different than what I see through my eyes. Like, who knows? Like there's no two beings that share consciousness. I know I'm going off into la la.
No worries. But it's true. It's true. It's true. No, so, and with that, we want to leave you guys with something true. A heartfelt thank you for listening in. And this has been Renzo del Castillo.
And Scott Raven coming at you with Poets on Film.
And remember to always keep it real.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.
In time, the Hudson Hawk would swoop down and erase my chalk line in the water. Before the Fraser Crane was driven insane by the pink flamingos in the throes of suicidal shows of a kamikaze bye-bye birdie, and administer me an amnesia antidote from Howl the Owl, who quoted Ginn's Bird. I saw the best bird brains of my generation destroyed by scarecrows, hunters, and blackbird pies, starving frantically featherless, dragging themselves through the skies at dawn, looking for a tangy mix of seeds of light and heeds in flight, a fancy angler-beaked dipsters yearning for the Orville-Wright connection to the aerodynamics of their existence.